I was talking with my youngest brother a couple of weeks ago. His name's Liam, and he was telling me about some work that he'd been doing the previous weekend at my other brother Paddy's place. And he was telling this story with just a little bit of glee and delight and mischief, because he had worked with my sister-in-law, Di, who was Paddy's partner, to convince Paddy that there were a couple of trees that needed to be chainsawed down. Now, this has been an ongoing project of Di's for several years, to try and convince Paddy that these trees need to be removed so that other ones can be planted beneath it. So he effectively conspired or collaborated with Di just to put a little bit of pressure on Paddy, who's not one to succumb to pressure, to convince him to cut down the trees. This had been a long-standing disagreement about the garden. They both love it, they just love it in different ways. And then a few days later, I popped around to visit Paddy and Di to get their version of the story. And we had a few laughs together about what had taken place. He showed me the big gap where these trees had been removed, and he showed me a text exchange, a slightly tongue-in-cheek text exchange that he'd had with a friend of his. Now, just to background this, because I want to share the exchange with you, the friend that he is sharing the exchange with, his wife is a lawyer who works for the United Nations Refugee Agency. It's just kind of a piece of information that'll help you capture what's going on here. So Paddy sends a text, and he sends it to BJ, and he says, "Liam and Di, the tree police, have ganged up on me, and we've lost a couple of trees in the backyard. I'm still in mourning. Hope you guys are fine and dandy amongst the fast-changing world we live in. Much love." BJ replies, and he says, "Think of it this way, Paddy." By the way, I've got permission from him to share this, just in case you're wondering about privacy issues. Okay. From he and Di to talk about this. "Think of it this way, Paddy. You'll have lovely wood to carve beautiful things out of." He is a carver. "From my perspective, the trees were getting too tall for the site, also killing off lawn roots, taking over the veggie plot. Thank goodness for Liam's input to get this over the line. Hear, hear for the tree police. They were beautiful at about half the height. I'm sure you guys have replaced them with suitable native flora. Love your place, front garden and back. Paddy." "Hear, hear, you say, hear, hear for the tree police, you say. Is there a place at The Hague where crimes against trees can be heard? The trees arrived as refugees after having been saved from the ravages of global warming, and now their fate has been sealed by the chainsaw. Long live the tree refugees." BJ replies, "Nice try, Paddy. But bringing in international refugee law, you would have to prove, A, the trees crossed a border, as one is not a refugee until they cross a border. Being native species, that might be a big ask on your part. And B, did the trees suffer persecution at some point? Looks like to me like they were well-loved and looked after, and they were given rights to grow and be strong. Trouble is, they grew too strong and perhaps took away the right of other plants. I know it must have been hard for you, Paddy, but give it time and see the wonderful plants you have planted come into their own. The circle of life, mate." Paddy replies, "How can one consider new possibilities before the old trees, who did no harm, are hardly cold? They lie there in their dismembered state, weeping sap from their deep wounds and still in their death throes. They probably can hear you all talking about them. It's a shame that it's too great to bear. I shall have to find 50 of their offspring, plant them, and tell the wee ones of the massacre that occurred. Gone, but not forgotten. Let new life take root, not in the sins and horror of ancestors, but in the promise and hope of a prosperous future." So here we have two nature lovers, and with very different ideas of how to tend and grow their garden, trying to figure out how to guard it, how to tend it, how to nurture it. And it seemed to me as I was thinking about today's passage or passages from Genesis that there's a similar kind of a dynamic going on in parts of the story. And I just want us to reflect on a few things because I think the passages that we've heard invite us to consider God's creation in a way that we may not have thought of before. I think it invites us to consider God's creation as God's beloved child. You see, in Genesis, the author doesn't offer a scientific description of the beginning of the time of space and time and matter, or the world that we know in this way, at least in one part of ourselves. Not presenting a description that we can use for an argument to convince others about origins. What we find here instead is a poetic description that's designed to move us to gratitude and joy and care and protectiveness and connectedness with where we are and who we are. So the writer describes God bringing the universe into being and shaping it, with the land emerging from the waters. Somewhat reminiscent of a child coming into the world as the waters are broken and new life emerges. It's an image, if you like, of birth. And then when God looks at what God has brought to birth, God declares it to be very good. Now, mums and dads, I just want to invite you for a moment to think about the children that you've been blessed with. I know that each mum and dad's experience of birth is different, and for some there is grief, there is pain, anxiety, fear, numbness, and other feelings and memories gathered around those experiences that evoke pain. But there are also, for many people, memories and experiences of birth that bring back to life the joy and the delight, the wonder and the gratitude that sprung up when you first held that new life, when you first held that new child. I've had the privilege with our five children of being present at each of those births and being alongside Jill in that process and then being able to hold my children in that way. And I know how my own soul was moved on each of those occasions. And sometimes each one is different, marked in its own way, but this sense of deep gratitude and awe and wonder and protectiveness that started flowing into my life and through my life through those experiences, the sheer beauty and the goodness of this gift that God had graciously brought into our world, or these gifts. And so here in this book of Genesis, I want to suggest to you that this is a picture that we could consider as something that might move our own lives, because we need more than simply ideas and arguments if we're to be moved into relationship with this place that we live in ways that will call forth the best of us to connect and engage and care for this place that we live, this place called Earth. I find it really interesting that in the Gospels, when Jesus is baptized, the records that Matthew and Luke particularly give us, slightly different versions of them, but it talks about this voice coming from heaven saying, "This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." And as I thought about that baptismal experience of Jesus, the one sent to reveal to us the heart and life and purpose of the Father for humanity and Christian thinking and experience, I see here too, that's an echo of what we're seeing in Genesis, God bringing creation to birth and then standing back and declaring, "This is good," and almost as the humans come into the story, say, "Listen to it. Listen to this child that I brought to birth and you're a part of. Listen to this creation. And that's put more explicitly later on in Psalm 19:1, where it tells us that the heavens declare the glory of God and the skies show forth his handiwork. Day after day pours forth speech. Night after night pours forth knowledge. The sense that creation is speaking to us. And the life of God within it is speaking to us and inviting us how to be in relationship with this place where we live. When you first read the text, however, it doesn't seem to say that. There's a language that's used that could suggest that there is a call to something else. In verse 26 of chapter 1, it says, "Let us make humankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they," and the way the English translations take the original Hebrew, or if they're using the Septuagint, the Greek language, the way they translate these languages is they use words like rule over or have dominion over the fish in the sea. And in the text that was read this morning, that was the word that was used, dominion. And then later on it says, God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it," is a word that's used here. And these words, have dominion, rule over, subdue, have been used by many people and interpreted in ways, pastors, politicians, everyday Christians, leaders of business and commerce, to endorse human domination over nature. They have been used in ways, in our own story here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, the missionaries and settlers that came here were often motivated by an understanding of this text to fill and subdue the earth and have dominion over it, to behave and act in ways which have been destructive to the people and place. Andrew Pickard, who's a former Kerry College lecturer who has written extensively around some of the history of conversation and political discourse in the early days of colonization, says that within the spheres of education, land, and war, British settlers employed distorted theologic to provide divine justification for their colonizing strategies and legitimize their destructive forces. Someone has suggested that this way of using text is text jacking. It's hijacking the text to justify a predetermined view and practice within the world in which we live. And as a result of that type of view and use of this particular text, or misuse, abuse of this particular text, we have seen all kinds of things emerge. It's been used to defend the unbridled exploitation of the earth, the planet that we live on, and looking to do it beyond as the means becomes available to travel to other places in our galaxy. It's being used to reduce nature to a human utility, just something that is useful to us, a resource that we can use to sustain the lives that we want to live. It's been used to support the unconstrained extraction of natural resources, to justify an indifference and sometimes a cruel disregard for other creatures, to dismiss the endangerment and extinction of species, to engage in the wanton degradation and destruction of ecosystems and habitats, to advocate for unconstrained economic systems and practices, to ignore the findings and warnings of science about the impacts of on environment and planet, and promote policies that accelerate environmental and planetary destruction. A text which presents to us a picture of a world being brought into existence and being through the loving action of God, and humans being invited to share that space alongside their fellow creatures and in partnership with God to be trustees and guardians, becomes a tool of destruction in the world in which we live. The good news is that many Christians do very carefully and thoughtfully reject this exploitative reading of Genesis 1 and 2. And they suggest if you look more closely at the context and the wider story of Scripture, that that this is a distortion, a dangerous distortion. The words that are used in the text paint a picture of stewardship and responsible oversight and companionship, not ruthless destruction or exploitation. They point out that the language of rulership and dominion referred to here are rulership that is done through a species, the human species, who carry the image of God within them. Humans, in other words, aren't to rule over creation in the way the text speaks about here, and they're to do it rather in a way that is consistent with the way God rules. And how does God rule? Well, if we see it embodied and demonstrated in the person of Jesus, it's not a coercion, a dominion, an exploitation. It's a coming under to serve and to heal and to resource and to nurture and to help flourish. That was the way of God in Christ in the world. But also when we look even at the Old Testament, we look at Psalm 72 verse 8, for instance, where the same word that is used, translated dominion in this text, is translated in a different way. It says, it describes God in this psalm, this song, as the one who delivers the needy when they call, the poor and those who have no helper, the one who has pity on the weak and needy and saves their lives. From oppression and violence, he redeems their life, and precious is their blood in his sight. So even within the scriptural record, there is this counter information which helps us see that to distort the text in this kind of way can only lead us into a place of tragic disconnection and destruction of the place called earth that God has called us to live. I too had a little look at Francis's Laudato Si on care for our common home, Pope Francis. And he kind of sums these two conflicting discourses up, or he challenges us to think differently. In it he writes, although it is true that we as Christians have at times incorrectly interpreted the scriptures, nowadays we must forcefully reject the notion that our being created in God's image and given dominion over the earth justifies domination of other creatures. The biblical texts are to be read in their context with an appropriate hermeneutic or interpretive grid, recognizing that they tell us to till and keep the garden of the world, to cultivate, to plough, to work with. This keeping means caring and protecting and overseeing and preserving. It implies a relationship of mutual responsibility between human beings and nature. And each community can take from the bounty of the earth what is needed for subsistence, but it also has the duty to protect the earth and ensure the fruitfulness for coming generations. As it says in Psalm 24, verse 1, the earth is the Lord. And the earth is the Lord's and the fullness of it, and all who dwell within it. So I feel this offering of an invitation to be trustees, to be gardeners with God, to be kaitiaki, to learn from mana whenua, tangata whenua, the people of this place, more about what guardianship looks like, while also learning from our own traditions to address some of the things that have led to abuse and misuse and disconnection. The story I started with is a story which is placed within a garden, and this story is in a garden too. And funnily enough, when this story carries on, that's not long before there's an argument over a tree. The Genesis story finishes up with an argument over a tree. And that argument, if you like, has consequences. A disconnect occurs between creator and the human and human beings, between human beings themselves, between human beings and nature, a disconnect, an internal and intrapersonal disconnect where they lose their sense of identity and calling and awareness of who they are and lose their way. And then there's this loving embrace of God saying, I'm here to lead you back into the place in which you fit within this world that I've created. It's often a challenge for two parents to agree how to care for their children. We come with our different suitcases and different ideas about how we're going to care for this child. And in this world, the same is true. But what is certain, if we look closely at this text and the story, is there is this deep, deep call to be trustees of God's creation. There is this deep call to be kaitiaki, to be gardeners alongside God. So I want to finish just with a poem by Joy Cowley, which captures some of this. Glorious are you, mystery of life, essence of all creation. You are the symphony of stars and planets. You are the music of the atoms within us. You are the dawn on mountain peaks, the moonlight on evening seas. Forest and farm, the rush of the city, everything is embraced in your love. We rejoice as we sing our gratitude. Glorious are you, O Jesus Christ, cosmic love in human flesh. You graced the smallness of time and place to teach us to dance to the music. You walk on our seas and heal in our streets. You make your home in our lives, revealing that cross and resurrection are one on the road to freedom. We rejoice as we sing our gratitude. Glorious are you, O Spirit of Truth. Wisdom and breath of our being. You are the wind that sweeps our senses. You are the fire that burns in our hearts. You are the needle of the inner compass, always pointing to the true north, guiding us on the sacred dance into the mystery of life. Let us sing and rejoice with gratitude.